The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
And you're very welcome along. It's Johnny Ward in the hot seat on OTB AM on this lovely, or rather quite grey, Friday morning in Dublin. We've loads to talk about. Very, very shortly, we're going to talk to Jason Quigley, who got back into the winning groove last night, overnight, when winning over in the States. And we're going to talk to him about what the future is going to hold after his victory, albeit an expected victory. But Jason obviously buzzing to get back now under the tutelage of Andy Lee. We're going to talk a lot about football as well, what's going on at Everton, a desperate result for Arsenal. I'm reading here, it's their worst run since 1977 after they lost to Brighton, and Aaron Connolly playing for Brighton last night. Newcastle United, who also had a bit of Irish interest in the form of Clark at the back, they had an excellent win over Sheffield United, which moved them up the table. So we have that to talk about, as well as obviously the boxing. We're going to have Tom Malone in studio later on to talk the sports news that's upcoming. Alan Quinlan will be in studio. We're going to dissect what's going on in terms of the IRFU's analysis or otherwise of what went on and what went wrong in the World Cup. We'll go through the sports pages. So we've loads of stuff coming through. We will have plenty of chat about football. And right at the end of the show, we'll have Paolo Malignaggi, who will be discussing. We have a pre-record with him. And we have Neil Tracy in the house.
How's it going, Johnny?
What's the crack? You're telling me you were away. You're just...
I was, yeah.
Back. You had nothing to lose. You went to Toulouse.
That's good, yeah. I'm back a few days now. I'm back on Sunday. But, yeah. It's amazing how much you do miss in the space of a week.
What did you miss?
I missed Jim Gavin.
Yeah.
Stepping aside. Well, no. I saw it just after it happened, kind of flicking around on Twitter. And I have to say, you know...
Were you shocked?
I was not hugely shocked. Surprised the timing, maybe. But you know, Johnny, you know I'm always in here on a Saturday afternoon. It's always all systems go in here on a Saturday. I have to say, on Saturday afternoon at about 12:45, maybe 15 minutes or so before Off the Ball was kicking off, and I was just browsing around on my phone while I was away on my holidays, and I saw...
You couldn't let it go.
Jim Gavin. Just flicking around.
Looking from afar.
Yeah. Huh? But I saw Jim Gavin had, you know... resigned and moved on.
The timing was
remarkable. I have to say, 15 minutes before the show, knowing it was going to be mayhem, I did sit back and go, oh,
thank God
yes.
I'm in Toulouse. Well, JD, to be fair, had to abort his brief, and we'd talk a lot about Jim Gavin. We had Joe Brolly on.
He did.
Was always interesting. Joe, I thought, spoke really, really well. And obviously, we had the Phillips Managerial Awards yesterday. Jim, I'm not sure if they had betting on it. I'm sure he was a short price to win it.
Yeah.
And he didn't rule out coming back. I guess that was one of the narratives of it.
Yeah, and what's been said in the papers anyway, which we'll get to a little bit later on, he didn't really say a huge amount otherwise.
Would you like him?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, you know, he's sticking to form anyway, but didn't give away too much. He said it was kind of something he'd been, you know, thinking about for a little while. He put a lot of thought into it. But he didn't give too much of a reason for why he's doing it. Just a few personal circumstances, I think, is what he... What he alluded to.
Are you speculating that it's work-related, basically?
I think part of it definitely is just that he's probably realised, you know what? It's probably not many better times where you can walk away.
Go out on a high.
Absolutely.
We have Jason Quigley on the line. Jason Quigley, were you as surprised as we were that Jim Gavin left the Dublin Post?
I have to say now, he's leaving on a high and the only way he can go is down from here on in. So I think it's a very sensible move that he is doing. And I think that he's probably doing it in a way that he's going to be remembered as the top dog.
And in terms of what he's done for Dublin, do you think now that the likes of Donegal, your own county, Galway, my county, might have a chance of actually doing something now that Gavin is gone? Because I see Mickey Hart is speculating Dublin might even be better after he's gone.
Yeah, well, Mickey Hart might be saying that, so if Tyrone beat them, it looks even better. it's hard to know. I think that at the end of everybody's reign or their long run that they have, there's always going to come a day where there's going to be a bad performance, there's going to be a slump, there's going to be something, and they are going to be toppled off the top three. And I think that Jim Gavin's got out at the right time now, and I think he has... moved away from that possibility of not being able to go on and continue the amazing run that they're doing. But without a doubt, I think that Donegal, obviously, and I'm going to say this, they're a great young team coming through. They have a lot of experience in there. They have a lot of good young players coming through. They're starting to hit a good run now at the minute. and really looking forward to the new year for them and seeing what they can produce.
Be honest now, after your return to the ring, you weren't expected to be quizzed on Jim Gavin.
Definitely didn't expect that question. That would have been last on the agenda, I thought.
Right, so you got back to win and raise. You were fighting a boxer. I guess you were expected to win. How did it go? It was fairly routine in the end. You're fighting Abraham Cordero in California. So I think it was like 1 o'clock Irish time. So I guess boxing fans woke up to the news. Those who hadn't stayed up for the fight woke up to the news that Jason Quigley is back in winning ways and onwards and upwards. But can you tell us how the fight went?
Yeah, it was a great fight for me to get back in the ring. Obviously, coming off my last.
I think we've lost Jason. We've lost Jason, so we're going to dial him up again. Looked a bit of a mismatch there in the old photo against Cordero. He's given 2 or 3 inches, if not more.
He certainly did.
There we are.
I think the real pity is that in the little time we had with Jason, we ended up. Talking about Jim.
Please get him back, lads, because it's like you had two questions. It's like, are you really the head of the Quickie Mart? So, Jason, Johnny Dunleavy, who I'd know, the Sligo Rovers player, great mates with Jason. So, if we've time, we could even talk League of Ireland. But I think we will have to get to boxing.
You can always work a League of Ireland angle in there somewhere.
You got it. Like, I've been told by the off the ball overlords, you know, we just can't talk League of Ireland much anymore. So, you know, it's coming up.
You're
to
being
Christmas.
Silenced. Yeah, no, it was a really good win for him, though, last night. I imagine, and I'm sure if we get him back in the next minute or so, we can probably ask him. Like, I would say over the last few months since that first defeat, there was probably a lot of pent-up anger and frustration and a lot of self-reflection over what could have been or should have been in the last fight and, you know, just waiting to get back out there, I imagine, is an incredibly important thing for a fighter when you've been knocked back like that, to just get a chance to go back and, you know, go out there and right your wrongs and stuff. And, you know, Andy Lee was on the show during the week and he was talking about how Jason's at that stage of the career where he's back as well. We have him, do we?
Yeah, I think what Neil is saying there, Jason, is effectively what Chris McNulty, your fellow Donegal man who was over at the fight, he was just saying you were kind of a lot of pent up frustration and you kind of, I suppose, you got rid of that last night in victory.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, as it says, look, it was a good fight for me to get back coming off my last fight. And it was a good fight for me to get in there, work on some of the things that I've been working on with Andy. And I had to be patient enough with him for the first round or two, obviously, because he was a tricky enough kind of fighter. He didn't really want to commit too much, but he was still kind of nice and loose and he threw his shots nice and loosely and everything like that. So it took me a round to kind of get the feel for him and everything like that. And once I did, I caught him in the second round. I thought I hurt him, but his eyes and everything were still kind of looking good and he still looked focused and all with it. And then in the third round, I caught him. I think it might have been a right hook and I just seen his eyes go spacey. I seen him like kind of looking as what's going on here. And I knew then that I had to put on the pressure and I did. And I maybe got a wee bit too excited and a wee bit wild at times, trying to go for the stoppage and land a big one kind of too quick, too fast, tried to go for too much. But as Andy, as Chris and all was saying, like it was a lot of frustration there from my last fight and a lot of excitement to get back in and get a good one and to get a good statement and everything like that. And my statement was I wanted to get in there and I wanted to stop this guy and push forward and stop it in good fashion.
We obviously know your association with Andy has, you know, it's fairly, I suppose it's still in its infancy, it's relative infancy, but did he kind of inculcate confidence in you going into the fight and what's your relationship been with Andy so far? We have him regularly on the show here and obviously speaks very highly of what you still have to offer.
Yeah, and like we all know, and you just know Andy chatting on the show and everything like that. He's very calm, cool, collected, and he brings that into the change rooms as well, and even into the corner, and between the rounds, he's very cool, calm, collected, and puts his point across, nice and controlled, and helps the boxer listen better because, you know, when you're in the heat of the moment, and rounds could be getting tough and hard and things like that, there you need somebody to go back into the corner and. Not going all mad and everything as well along with the fight. And Andy's very good like that, and his presence in the gym as well all that there kind of effect comes off onto me, and he's instilled a lot of things in me at a very early stage that we're working on at the minute. You know, we've only really been working maybe the guts of 2 to 3 months together, and I have to say it has been, every session in the gym's a real learning session with them, and it's so enjoyable getting in there because you're always learning something new, you're always working on something new, and it's great. So it is, and I really enjoyed the whole build up out here with Andy in California, the preparations, everything like that. It went very, very well, and we're delighted to get the ball running now for the first one.
We spoke about this beforehand, Neil. Like, Andy could just have something about him here as a coach.
Yeah, and I was thinking as well, Jason, like, I mean, when Andy had his first fight, it was kind of along the same lines developmentally as probably you probably would have been in your career. I think it was even, you know, you would have had the same record up until that first defeat. Has he been good even just kind of with the mental tips and stuff like that for getting back on the horse and getting back going again?
Yeah, without a doubt, because you can even sense it. Like, some of the things that Andy's been telling me, obviously, are related to them very much. And then I understood a few things that he was saying. Like, you know, in the changing rooms, walking to the ring, the little thoughts of your last fight can come back into your head, you know what I mean? And that's the last thing you want to be thinking about, walking into the ring for your next fight. But these wee things come along and you have to deal with them, and getting in there and getting a good victory and getting the stoppage won, those are the types of things that gets those doubts and thoughts out of your head.
How are you feeling, I suppose, as well? I mean, what's a good age for a boxer? Where are you at in terms of what are you, 28 now?
Yeah, 28 years of age now.
So is that back on track, or is this kind of going to be the start of a rebirth in terms of your career?
Yeah, well, I'm 28 years of age now. Obviously, came off my first defeat. I'm back now to winning ways. And as Andy has been saying a few times on the show and everything as well, you're 2 or 3 fights away from a world title fight or a massive fight to get yourself into a world title fight. And that's the special thing about boxing. You know, people can get a defeat, but within 1 or 2 fights, they can be back right back up where they were in the beginning. And I had a great chat with Robert Diaz tonight, Golden Boy Promotions, and my management team and everything as well after the fight. And, you know, they want me another 1-2 more fights, and looking to get back out now early in the new year, maybe February, coming out to LA in January for a month's training camp here with Andy and Paddy Donovan as well. And we're going to push forward now and get those 2-3 fights and push on then for the world title.
That next fight, is that looking to be a bit closer to home maybe, do you think?
I'm not too sure. I just got told that they're going to get me back out in February. That's as far as I know, and I've only found that out myself about an hour or two ago. So that's good fresh news for you there, lads.
Yeah, and the Jim Gavin stuff. But can you just explain that? Because, like, I guess there was a debate as to where you should be boxing. Like, was it the logical step to be over in the States, or was it more logical to be sort of coming back here? But you're not really sure where it's going to end up.
Yeah, it's like a football player playing for Finn Harps. He's going to be playing in Finn Park. He's not going to be playing down in Cork City's ground, you know what I mean?
Andy Lee is now Ollie Horgan now.
That's for sure. You know, like, I'm signed with Golden Boy Promotions. Golden Boy Promotions, 70 to 80% of their shows is held on the west coast of America. They have a few in Texas. They have very few, maybe 1 or 2 on the off chance Canelo fought in Madison Square Garden and things like that. So this is something that we're going to have to sit down and talk with Golden Boy Promotions about, that I am an Irish fighter. I want to be fighting on the East Coast, or I want to be fighting back in Ireland. But I think I'm at the stage of my career now where I have been away from Ireland that long that I want to come back now with a massive fight. I don't want to come back now with just a 10-rounder or anything like that. I want to come back with a massive fight, a world title eliminator or a world title itself. That's the kind of stage that I'm at now, and that's the kind of questions that I'm going to be pushing towards Golden Boy and my management team to start pushing that and getting that into place.
So ideally you're like looking at this fight in front of a massive home crowd in Dublin or something like that?
Yeah, like, that's the goal, you know what I mean? That's always been the goal of my career. But as I says, I want to come back with a meaningful fight. Like, I want to come back with something big, because that's what Ireland's lacking. Like, you know, we need to be filling the three arena with boxing shows, and we need to be filling it out because the boxing fans are there, and the boxing fans deserve it of Ireland because of the support that they've given us, not only me, but boxers through the years as well. It's been unbelievable, and everyone knows the support of the Irish. Like, we need to get boxing, big time boxing, back in Ireland, three arena, whatever it has to be, you know what I mean?
Very briefly, just you mentioned Paddy Donovan, and I was talking to Andy about him. He couldn't kind of hide his excitement there a few months ago. How good is this kid from Limerick?
Paddy's top class. You know, he's a special talent, and I think he can go all the way, especially now being under Andy. And obviously having the likes of myself in the gym too, that's still in the professional game, that's still going towards that top level. You know, I've been through a lot of things in my sport as well, in the boxing game professionally, and that I can, you know, gym chat. Do you know what I mean? Just simple gym chat in the changing rooms, things like that there, asking and answering little questions. It's all going to be a massive help. And then we've been doing a few rounds sparring and everything as well. So we've had, and Paddy's going to be fighting now on the 20th of December. And there's a reason Andy's excited. He's a top-class talent, and I'm excited too to see how far he can really go.
Just to finish up, yeah, you're all over Twitter trending now. You're Jim Gavin comments, so you weren't expecting that. But
that's why the little stumble happened. I had to go check my Jim Gavin notes there.
Yeah, like I actually thought it was some sort of internet issue. But Jason, thanks a million, and congrats again.
Top stuff, lads. Appreciate
top
it.
Top cheers, Jason.
Great lad.
Yeah.
Just a great lad, yeah. I don't know. I mean, there has to be a very good little documentary of their gym in Harrods Cross, the three lads there. Of spend like, I don't know when Paddy, I think Paddy might have a fight upcoming, but obviously Jason's well back on track. And you have Andy, as he says, that calming influence. He's such a likeable bloke. And
yeah.
It's interesting he said that about, like, there is huge interest in boxing, but I don't know, are we at a lull in Ireland at the moment? Obviously, Carl Frampton's doing loads of stuff, but, like, there doesn't seem to be these great fights like in Dublin anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't think it's for the lack of a want.
Mm.
I think it's there are other issues at play that, you know, fights aren't being put on here. Like, we're seeing a lot of big MMA cards and stuff like that coming to Dublin. Mm. And you're seeing a lot of, you know, big fights happening up north in Belfast, but it's down here in, not just in Dublin, but all around Ireland, where there are, you know, there are not that many big fights.
Let's get to the papers. We don't have any Jason Quigley in the papers because it was beyond the deadline, but let us get to what is in the papers. OTB AM. Do you want to start?
You go. You've Racing Post there, right at the top.
Racing Post is the top one, and this is actually a lovely story. So Holly Doyle, I did a little piece, you'll find it on my Twitter feed or whatever, with Vanessa Mae, who's made incredible strides as a rider. Female flat jockeys wouldn't be exactly common in Ireland. They've done very little actually for years, but it's slightly different in Britain for whatever reason. Josie Gordon, ex-champion apprentice, and Holly Doyle beat her record of winners in a year, 107 winners in a calendar year, comfortably before the end of the year. Holly, a really, really good rider, making great strides and doing wonders, I think, for the prospect of young kind of up-and-coming girls who might have an interest in racing getting into what is obviously a dangerous sport but an exhilarating one as well. So that's the top of the Racing Post.
I've got the back page here of the Irish Independent, the sports section, and the big story, I think, is what everyone is waiting for at around 12 o'clock this afternoon. FAI expected to reveal debt bomb of more than €50 million. This story from Aidan Fitzmaurice and John Fallon. So they say Irish football is being told to prepare for a bomb when the FAI's accounts are presented today. Debts of €50 million expected. And quotes from the former CEO, Bernard O'Byrne, who says that any possible new sponsors to take over from three would likely stay away from a toxic FAI until more changes are made at board level.
Joe is in my ear. He's just wondering, is the debt bomb an actual quote? Because he likes the quote.
It is quoted as saying bomb, yes. It's in inverted commas.
The Indo have done an interesting thing here. They went to kind of one of the former guys who knew what he was talking about, Bernard Byrne, who's now involved in the Basketball Ireland, I think.
Yeah, and there's more from him as well on the inside of the paper there as well, actually speaking to Aidan Fitzmaurice.
He speaks about how he's friendly with Paul Cook, and Aidan has some very good stuff on that. I know at the end of the piece, then he references Shane Ross and kind of the FAI board having absolutely no relationship with Ross. But he does have some really notable points about the lack of communication to people within the FAI about what's actually happening. And the this is just so gloriously Irish. The FAI had its Christmas party last night. Now, if ever there was a day not to be hungover, like, it's just, but it's
They're saying a €50 million debt is, it's a conservative estimation is what a lot of people are saying as well.
It's going to be carnage, and Aidan has a good line about John Delaney's kind of prediction that the debt could be gone by the end of 2020. His line is something like, this is laughable were it not actually such a serious matter. And there are going to be cutbacks and there are going to be job losses because of the ineptitude of the FAI's running over the last while. And it's sad on a human level. It's also sad because so many clubs are waiting on money and grants, and Sports Ireland obviously have still kind of just call a halt to any dealings with the FAI. So it's quite tragic in sporting terms.
It really is, yeah. And there's lots more on it. I might actually jump in before you go to the... Before we actually do the back page of the sports section of the Irish Times, like Emmett Malone has some good stuff really on it here. Like, you know, also confirmation expected today of what the final payment John Delaney would have been given from the FAI is. I haven't heard many people talking about that as well. It's just been the sheer size of the debt, and obviously that is a huge thing.
It's actually a sideshow at this stage. There's so many other things going on, I suppose.
But he's got a really just a very good opening paragraph of wider Ireland than anything to go by. A decade after the crash, it's hard to feel confident that the lessons of what went wrong at the FAI will really be learned here at home. But they may well be taught the world over. Lecturers in law, business or sports governance might construct entire courses around the mismanagement of football's governing body during the past decades or more. Students, in turn, will be amused, amazed and horrified by the tales of ineptitude, denial and excess. It is hard to imagine a single one of those classes will be delivered without the mention of the name of former chief executive John Delaney. That's from Emmett Malone in the... in the Irish Times
without proposing the notion in any way, shape or form that journalists had an agenda in this, because they didn't. All through the last 10-15 years, football journalists were trying to report on what was going on at the FAI, and eventually got to the stage where, you know, they basically couldn't ask questions anymore. But you can tell from the articles since John Delaney's sort of demise that from the likes of Emmett, from Aidan Fitzmaurice, from Daniel McDonald, from Neil O'Riordan, from Owen Cowser and so on and so forth, they are simmering with anger over the way they were sort of treated and sidelined. And it's coming out now, and Emmett's done some great stuff on it, but it's just, that's what happens when you've a dysfunctional regime and kind of power is vested in too few people.
Yeah.
There's definitely a lesson to be learned.
Certainly
no
is.
Power in Silva anymore at Everton. This is the Daily Telegraph. Silva bullet, manager sacked by Everton after 10-hour wait at training ground. Pereira tops Goodison wanted list as Ferguson takes temporary charge. And that was the sacking that was always going to happen, whether it was before or after Unai Emery was the question.
Yeah, and I was a bit surprised when it came to the timing of it. Like,
we have the same headline here, actually.
There's a few of them that have gone with it.
It's rare enough you get that. It's not like they have like a WhatsApp group of all the sub-editors of the paper say, well, I'm going with this, don't go with that tomorrow.
I was wondering, though, is sometimes the...
This is the mirror.
Is the pun a little bit so obvious that sometimes do they look at it and go, everyone's going to have that one.
I'm a man for simplicity. I think, you know, sometimes less is more. And less is more would sum up Jim Gavin in many ways in terms of his media interaction. But it's better for everyone that I left Jim. And this is Mick Scully, who was talking to him at the Phillips Managerial Awards, or was quoting him from that. Is it better for everyone that he left? It's questionable. Dublin players apparently in tears when he left and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
he's been a huge part of them. He's, you know, for a lot of them, he's been the only manager they've known.
Tommy Rooney had a tweet saying he was a little bit frustrated by the silence of the players afterwards.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
I don't know. I don't know. Just off the top of my head, even, I'm trying to figure out how many of them are very active on social media.
it's not social media. It's just like, give me a line in Jim Gavin. It's not like Jim was an asshole. It's like Jim was great. That's all I need.
Yeah.
But the players have, I don't know. I think they were a bit shocked by it, and they've been so used to that Dublin media regime for so long. They're just like, nah, don't fancy it.
I don't know. Like, completely guessing. I'd say it probably did come.
And that's
out
what
the
we
blue
do on
for,
the show.
Yeah, exactly. Completely guessing, based on nothing but a hunch. I'd say I doubt too many of the players knew it had happened, knew it was going to happen until it was, absolutely, you know, until it was public and announced. I think Jim Gavin's always been the kind of guy that he goes about his own business very, very quietly. And I'd say it's very hard to kind of get beyond the outer shell when it comes to him as well. Staying on Dublin GA though, because the front of the sports section of the Irish Times today, there's a couple of Dublin-related pieces. First, decision to step down in the interest of Dublin. Gavin, just as we had there on, what newspaper was it, just a moment ago?
That was the Mirror, yeah.
Yeah, these are the same quotes from the Signify Sports Manager of the Year Awards. No longer that other title.
Ah.
Yeah.
I apologise.
Yeah,
that was quite, should signify that, actually.
You should, yeah. Yeah.
There
but
were
also,
a lot of journals at the old Jolly Up. I missed out this year.
Did you, yeah?
It's always interesting to pit managers together from different sports, including horse racing trainers, and I think they genuinely do enjoy meeting people that aren't in their sport.
Yeah.
And journalists, obviously.
But also, as well, over on the left-hand side, Gavin Comiskey writing, Costello questions standards at RTE. So John Costello, the Dublin GA chief executive, has questioned the standards and editorial choice adopted by RTE's primetime show in the immediate aftermath of the Capital football team clinching an historic 5 in a row of All-Ireland titles. In his wide-ranging annual missive, he addresses primetime, suggesting that due to Dublin's abundant resources of population and sponsorship, there will never again be real equality in the game. So yeah, not too happy about that. It seems that John Costello's report every year is something that, it's one of those things that people just, journalists, like, really just set their watches to.
It's like the bishop and the priest in the pulpit. He's going to be giving out about something.
See what John Costello has to say this year.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I think I think there's a fair bit of merit in that primetime report, to be fair. Here is the Irish Daily Star. Goodbye. I don't get this, actually. Goodison, is it? Or
Goodison. That's it, yeah. That's tame.
I'm not mad on that one now. It's gone from bad to worse. Arsenal's worst run since 1977, 5 years before I was born. Back in the days of proper football, terraces and, you know, just working class people watching players getting a working class wage, more or less. But there you have today's modern player, David Luiz, reacting angrily, and Lundberg hasn't gone great for him so far, and obviously then Silva axed as Everton looked to Moyes. Jim rules out going elsewhere, and then we should mention this as well, duo slam headline, Chris Smalling and Romelu Lukaku have slammed Italian newspaper Corriere dello Sport for labelling their upcoming reunion tonight Black Friday. I mean,
how you can justify it is
I've been to Italy many times, like, it's just their attitude to this stuff is I don't know. I mean, it's just how they thought that was a good idea.
Yeah. I think they've kind of doubled down on it as well.
They have, does that make it, I don't know. There leaves a lot to be desired, their attitude towards racism in that country.
Absolutely. Silver Bullet that's three for Silver Bullet. Oh, we got four there.
Silver.
We have another one just
there
down below.
They didn't have the WhatsApp group going.
They certainly did. This is on the Guardian, I think. Yeah, so Silver Bullet Ferguson steps up after Everton put manager out of Goodison misery. I am kind of looking forward to seeing Duncan Ferguson as a Premier League manager, I have to say.
Do you remember Duncan Ferguson as a player?
I would, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not that young, John.
You are quite, well, I'm kind of flattering you here, but yeah. Big Dunk, I used to obviously be a Liverpool fan back in the day, and Goodison for the Derby games would be rocking, and in Liverpool's days when they were pretty shaky at the back, which was much of the early to mid-90s, Big Dunk was a nightmare. And you know, this notion, you see him on the pitch and he would strike fear in you. Apparently he's a great bloke. He does lots of good stuff off the pitch and very, very much respected. And old style forward with a good left foot, but impossible to deal with in the box.
It would have been absolutely, imagine how much fun it would have been the other night. Duncan Ferguson managing Everton, the Merseyside derby at Anfield.
I don't know. I suppose the chasm is so great at the moment, it might have been. Like, if you had an Everton team that could challenge Liverpool, Liverpool made, what, five or six changes? Actually, I put it to you, Neil Tracy.
Let's go for it.
Jonathan Higgins of our stable, he said, like, you know, he was making the point about Salah being dropped. He was like, what would have happened if Salah had been dropped earlier this season? Would Liverpool be doing even better? Because Origi was very good the other night. Salah's been poor. He's not himself.
How much, like...
Everton were crap as well, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, like, even if Liverpool were to have been better, it's just better in terms of, like, goal difference, isn't it?
There aren't many games they would have won because they've won nearly every game. They might have
won all but one of them. Yeah, maybe you're talking
Salah
Champions
was
League
poor
and stuff.
Or in both Napoli games.
If you're talking Premier League, like, I mean, they would only be 2 points better off at a maximum.
I'm going to say this, and I think the love in for Salah masks how badly he's been playing in many games over the last season and a third. Origi should definitely be challenging for a place more regularly, I think, because Origi's not a bad player. He's brilliant the other night. Dovetailed brilliantly with Mane. Did a great relationship. Mane and Salah's relationship this year has not been what it should be. I don't know what's going on with Salah. Obviously, he's carrying an injury, but he breaks down so many Liverpool attacks where the Salah of 2 years ago would just score. And it may also go down to the fact that he's had barely a break from football for like 2 years. Mm-hmm. And he's such a good player. I think he shouldn't be sacrosanct in terms of being dropped.
No, definitely not.
Freddie's Nightmare is a really clever headline in the Irish Daily Mail. And Lundberg with an expression that kind of is to say, what have I gotten myself in for here, or how crap is this Arsenal team? Everton fire boss and call in Big Dunk. And Gavin, I've no regrets. So consistency in terms of the narrative across the papers this morning.
Yeah, same as well on the back page of the Times. Everton sack Silva and turn to Ferguson. But also over on this side of the page, Paul Hurst saying, players urge United, don't act Solskjaer. Man United's players told the club's hierarchy before their key victory against Spurs that they should not sack Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Solskjaer's position as United manager had come under scrutiny after winning only 4 of his opening 14 games last season, but the squad remained convinced that the former Norway striker is the right man to take the club forward.
I'm baffled by Manchester United, I have to say. I really fancied Spurs to beat them the other night, and probably read a bit too much into Mourinho's
I think that's what's frustrating United fans so much.
Against Sheffield United and Villa. Yeah. I can't say how bad they were. Yeah. And then they were at it the other night. Yeah. They weren't great, but they were much, much better.
And like the game against Liverpool at Old Trafford was probably up until the Spurs game their best performance of the season. And I'd say on another day they probably should have won that game. Mm-hmm. And then they go, you know, you're talking all those other results as well, and the early season games, like, well, off the top of my head, Crystal Palace, that's when they, you know, came from behind the last minute and all of a sudden conceded another goal to lose again. It's just, it's 2 steps forward and 2 steps back.
You watched them the other night, Neil. Like, if they could play a tactical game that's all about breaking on the counter, because defensively they're fine defensively in general. They've been good defensively this season, particularly in Europe. If they could develop a game plan that basically involves pace on the break, Spurs were really at 6s and 7s defensively against them the other night. Now, the goals were kind of, they weren't things of beauty, but Spurs were struggling and they've so much pace and they haven't had Pogba, and it's kind of hard to know where Pogba's, what'll happen with him, because obviously there are rumours that Solskjaer has kind of run out of patience.
With Pogba?
Yeah, it's like, because what's his influence in the dressing room? He hasn't been playing for quite a while now, and it's like, but anyway, they still have issues, but I think Solskjaer definitely bought himself quite a bit of time.
He's definitely bought himself, probably talking another, at least another couple of months, probably.
The best headline we have saved until last, and to be fair to the Sun, it often does come up with the best. Flop Silva has cost him 16 million. Toffee dough nuts. Board split over move for Moyes. Moyes would be an interesting one. They say he should never go back and all that.
I was reading in another couple of places, it looks like it's not going to happen. I think they've spoken about it, but I don't think too many people are that keen. And from what I can read, anyway, from what I've seen, it seems like they're at a stage where they don't really know what they're after at the moment. Like the other name floating around was Jorge Jesus. He's managing Flamengo, but he doesn't speak English, so that obviously is a problem. As a lot of people would have pointed out when Unai Emery was at Arsenal, that was the language barrier was an issue. So it's hard to see who's available for Everton, who they go about getting.
Do you know what is interesting about Everton, right? They're in the bottom three. Mm-hmm. You look at the teams above them. Southampton are going pretty well at the moment. Villa, not a bad side. Were excellent against Man United. I think they'll be confident enough of staying up. West Ham would definitely think they should be in a better position than they are. Bournemouth have been consistently excellent under Eddie Howe. Then you have Newcastle, who are going really well, Burnley and Brighton. Everton, at the moment, wouldn't be guaranteed to stay up the way they're playing. And it'll be very interesting, because a lot of those teams ahead of them will actually fancy their chance of finishing ahead of Everton, I think, which would be catastrophic for the Toffees. I don't know when they were last relegated.
Yeah, well, long before the Premier League era, anyway. But even just looking at the table, like, I'd say two teams that be feeling a bit concerned, West Ham and Bournemouth, definitely. I know West Ham had a win recently enough, but they've had desperate form since...
Coach under pressure?
Since what was a really, really good start to the season. And Bournemouth as well. Like, Bournemouth go through spells, I think, in every season where they have a disastrous couple of months, and they're the kind of team that they can pick off four or five wins in the space of six or seven games, and all of a sudden it shoots them back up the table and they're feeling a lot more comfortable again. But there is a fine scrap going to be had between, like, anyone in the bottom 10 realistically is in a bit of bother. Like, Newcastle somehow up in 11th place.
I got to give
halfway,
it to Steve Bruce.
More or less halfway. Now, they're playing wretched football.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Like,
I'm laying out both sides of this now.
They got a draw at home to Man City Saturday, which I think, like, nobody would have given them a chance. I think Bruce, you know, the regime he's in dealing with there, taking over from one of the best coaches in the world, arguably, in Benitez. And, you know, he's a local lad. People probably said, oh, they'll get relegated. They're level with Arsenal and they're 11th at the moment. And fair play to Bruce, like, for they had a desperate start.
Yeah.
And, you know, the players came out and said, it's not good enough. He's a likeable bloke. He's done a great job so far. He really has.
Yeah. But, like, we'll say, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a Newcastle fan last night after they'd won. And I was saying to him, like, I know how he felt when Steve Bruce came in at the start of the season, how much doom and gloom. And I was saying, like, you know, obviously you're still pining for Rafa. You're still pining for the X. And I was saying, like, are you...
Pining for the X?
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, just bringing it back to a new level of...
Exactly, but I was going to say, like, there. Is there somebody that's kind of torn that they're actually getting those results? They're in a comfortable place on the table, halfway towards the 40 points.
Are you still pining for the X?
But are you still... Is there an element of frustration that Steve Bruce is doing this and the football's awful and you're kind of... He said that, like, you're definitely torn.
So many love analogies there. Yeah. Something is... The football is
because
awful.
Because also
torn.
As well, if... No, but like we'll say, if Steve Bruce...
Relationship's going better than you thought.
If Steve Bruce gets them a mid-table finish this season, then...
No longer pining for the X?
No, but we'll move away from the X for now.
Forget about
We're
going
to move on from the X.
That was a year ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But if they get a good mid-table finish and, you know, in that middle third of the table, you know, in that
no man's land.
Yeah, that no man's land.
Which is underrated, by the way.
Yeah, but which for them at the start of the season would have been a great finish.
100%.
All of a sudden, Mike Ashley probably looks at it and go, I've done a decent job this year with this club, you know?
I
would say there are a lot of fans out there that... They want things to go a little bit bad because...
Ashley might go.
Because Ashley might go. If things start to improve, Ashley might try stick around a little bit longer.
I saw Mike Ashley outside, I think it was Hogan's. Like, it was outside a bar in Dublin. He was on the phone.
Like, recently enough.
Two summers ago, maybe.
Right.
But it was around the time there was a lot of chat about Benitez. And it was one of those moments where I'd want this lad to kind of... when you see a celebrity who's... basically having a drink or he's having a coffee or whatever, he doesn't want to be bothered by people annoying him.
Yeah.
So I was like, this could be a really good interview. Like, he's on the phone. I could go, Mike, what's the crack? Welcome to Dublin. And fill them with absolute plomos. Like, I mean, you get such a bad press. Like, you're actually a good lad. You're a businessman. Look at your achievements. And by the way, would you fancy a pint? And all of a sudden, but I bottled it and I didn't do anything. Anyway, I don't know what he was doing in Dublin, but he's an intriguing character. But Newcastle, it's an intriguing season. And they are up to 11th in the table. And before we finish with the Premier League, who wins the scrap for fourth? Chelsea at the moment, 6 points ahead of Wolves. Man United, 8 points behind Chelsea.
I think Chelsea will.
We have a video to go to.
We do.
OTB AM.
The way they're playing, they're not going to let it go, Richie.
Yeah.
You know, and again, see, it's that's new to them. In Manchester City's place, they've won it for the last 2 years, and you know, they won, well, the last five trophies apparently in the domestic leagues and cups. And I think when you do that, it is hard to maintain it unless you're introducing new players. You know, if you go back to the old times with Liverpool, with Kenny Dalglish and Hansen and Graeme Sinisa, nearly every year when they were winning regularly, they'd add two players to it.
Mm.
You know, City haven't done that. They brought Rodri during the close season. But if you look at the transfer situation over the last 2 years, they haven't changed the team much. You know, I think they should have bought, like, say, two or three players this season or every season. And, like, Liverpool still have that hunger. You know, they haven't won the league for a long time. They have the hunger to do it. And City haven't quite got that hunger, in my opinion, this year. Mainly, I think, because, well, they won it last year and they won it the year before and they won domestic trophies. So Liverpool, I don't think, will lose it with a lack of attitude.
Daniel Harris is on the line. How are you, Daniel?
I'm good, thanks. You all right?
Not too bad, actually. Neil Tracy, just as we were listening to John Giles there, he made the point, since Mourinho has left, Man United have literally gone full circle. And anyone who's listening in but not watching, I'm making a circular motion here. So they've gone from, like, the massive high of Solskjaer's first 8-odd games, then they were absolutely terrible, and now they're kind of Mourinho-esque okay again. Discuss.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because you can make, there are lots of criticisms that you can make of Solskjaer, mistakes he's made that he shouldn't have made, and perhaps players he's bought and the way he spent the money. But when you judge him, you have to bear, I think, two things in mind. One thing you have to remember is that he's not a particularly experienced manager. And in the way of a young player, you allow them to make mistakes and they get better, then they make mistakes, then they get better. And eventually you end up with a finished product. And it was never likely to be the case that Solskjaer was that finished product. There's a pretty good chance that he's not good enough to manage Manchester United, that he's not the man to manage Manchester United. Of the 7 billion people in the world, most of the people aren't the right man to manage Manchester United. So the idea that a guy who also happened to score the goal that won the treble and be this great fan favourite is also a brilliant football manager just seems ridiculous. So the chances are he's not the right man, but you have to allow him to learn on the job because he isn't the finished article. I think the other thing that people have to bear in mind is that he's also had quite a lot of bad luck as United manager. If you think about just this season, he's basically not had Pogba almost the whole season. And Pogba is his best player by far. He's not had Martial, who was someone who he was relying on. I mean, that itself sounds ridiculous, but someone who he was relying on for quite a lot of the season. As soon as Martial came back and United started to play a bit better, McTominay, the one midfield player he can't do without, then he got injured. But when he's had most of his good players available, so the two games against Chelsea, the game against Tottenham the other night, you've actually seen a team that looks like, with a couple of signings and with some improvements, might actually turn into something worth talking about.
Daniel, just to go back on something you said early on in that point there, you mentioned how, like, Solskjaer coming in, he has to learn on the job. We're almost, like, coming up on a year into it now. In your opinion, how much have we seen him learn, actually learning on the job? What do you think we have seen him learn?
I think that he's got quite a good idea of who the good players are, and I think he actually sussed that out pretty quickly. He started off playing a sort of a 4-2-3-1. Now he's playing what looks more to me like a 4-3-3, and I think that is the best way of getting the most out of his players. He learned that Marcus Rashford, and I mean, I say he learned as though it was something that I knew. It wasn't something that I knew. I thought Marcus Rashford was a centre forward, but we're watching Marcus Rashford play now, and it's actually pretty clear that he's a wide attacker off the left. So he's learned that. He decided that that was what Harry was going to play at the beginning of the season, and that's working pretty well now. He had to play Marcus Rashford on through the middle when Martial was injured. That didn't work so well, except he didn't have to do that when Martial was injured, and I think that's one of the mistakes that he made. And something that perhaps he's learned is that if you look at the game on Tuesday, he played Mason Greenwood through the middle, and that kept Rashford where he's most dangerous. And Mason Greenwood is a centre forward, and he looks like he's someone who's ready to damage Premier League defences. So it was actually a bit odd. Before the game against Tottenham, Solskjaer said to Amazon, gosh, what a ridiculous sentence that
Amazon.
Is. Solskjaer said to Amazon that he'd like to order some books, but could he cancel his Brit anyway? That he's been looking forward to the opportunity to see Greenwood play centre-forward against the Premier League defence. And I was kind of sitting there watching it, like shaking my hand, shaking my head, because shaking his neck, because when Martial was injured, he steadfastly refused to play Greenwood almost at all in the league, never mind through the middle. And by playing Greenwood through the middle, I thought we could see that his movement was excellent. He gave options, he showed for the ball, he held up the ball better than I feared that he might. And now I hope that he keeps his place for the weekend and beyond that.
You're doing an awful lot of shaking there, Dan.
He's just thinking about Amazon.
Yeah, that's why we like going. I mean, that's the nature of football. It's you have no control over something that you have, to which you have ascribed this ludicrous value in your pathetic little life.
See, we can all relate to this in that, like, basically, it's the great triviality sport. There's an awful lot of crap going on in the world. And instead of talking about the Amazon rainforest, we're talking about Solskjaer giving a comment to Amazon.
Yeah.
On a Friday morning.
It's at in equal parts the most and least important thing in the world.
It is the most important for the next hour and 10 minutes anyway. But Daniel, like this, and I mean this, Man United looked like a team at times the other night. Spurs were in ribbons trying to deal with their pace. Has he stumbled on a formula with McTominay in that midfield that he's like, he's got a pace-driven team that's going to hit teams on the break, or are we going to limp into another kind of period of good result, bad result?
I don't think he stumbled upon it. I mean, I think what we're seeing now is probably quite close to what he planned. But I do think we will probably see good performances and bad performances, partly because he doesn't have any strength. There are a few players he just can't afford to lose. And it's unlikely that these players will be able to sustain their top form throughout a whole season. And he also, I don't think he particularly wants to be a counter-attacking side. I just don't think he has that many options, because he doesn't have the players in midfield to outpass all the teams in the league. So I think that by their nature, United are a counter-attacking side, because that's something that they can do, that if they do it well, it's very hard to defend against. But in terms of dominate, like against City tomorrow, you're not going to see United suddenly dominate the possession, because teams tend not to do that against City. I mean, Chelsea did it the other week, but I think that was the first time in 2 years or something that anyone had done that. Mm. So I wouldn't expect to see McTominay, Fred, and whoever the third man in midfield is dominate the ball, but you will see United cause City a lot of aggravation on the counter, I think.
Yeah, because City defensively, Neil, are there for the taking a bit at the moment. Mm. And what are you thinking in relation to this game? Because this is like a proper test for Man U.
Yeah, like I think based on what United did against Spurs the other night, it probably is making a few City fans a little bit nervous. Mm. Daniel, what are you thinking?
I'm not sure they will make City fans nervous, but City fans will know that any team with half-decent attackers has caused them grief this season. I mean, they lost to Norwich. They've been caused grief by they're caused grief by Chelsea. And United have attackers that are at least as good, if not better, than what those teams have. And they're very good on the break, and they probably have a bit of confidence now. So they know that any team that can get at their defence will cause their team trouble. And the reality, though, is that's sort of been the case for 2 years. Any team that can get at City's defence could cause them trouble. It was the case when Guardiola was at Barcelona as well. The difficulty was actually getting to that point where you're anywhere near their defence. And City haven't been keeping possession as well. They haven't been pressing as well. They haven't been running as hard. So they are more vulnerable than they have been. But their best is still probably the best of any side in the world. So it does depend not just on how well United play, but probably depends quite a lot more on how well City play. If City turn up and they play 90%, then you'd probably see them win by a couple of the goals, because you'd see them do that to most teams in the world.
What percentage are they playing at the moment, do you think, City?
I didn't see them against Burnley the other night, but apparently they were really good. I saw them against Chelsea a couple of weeks ago, and that sort of seemed to be the start of them warming up. And they played at about 30% for most of the first half, and 70%, I would say, was enough to beat Chelsea from behind. So that tells you how high City's top level is, because Chelsea are a decent team, and City still beat them from behind without playing particularly well. But as you say, there are some vulnerabilities there, and United definitely have the means to exploit those vulnerabilities. The problem for United now is, after spending the first few months of the season struggling to score goals, they're now struggling to keep them out. And not just struggling to keep them out, but struggling to keep them out at the right times. So it's all very well conceding relatively few goals, which they have still done. if you're conceding one in every game rather than scoring four and conceding two, then winning a game 1-0, that is problematic. And that's what they're doing. They're not keeping any clean sheets. And as long as you do that, then you'll struggle to win games against good teams.
Obviously, Alex Ferguson detailed this getting Liverpool off their perch when he took the job, which he more than succeeded in, such that for, I don't know, two decades or thereabouts. There's Sir Alex, who was at the game the other night. For pretty much all of his reign, Liverpool were subservient to Manchester United. That is overwhelmingly no longer the case. What's the attitude to Manchester United? What's the attitude among Manchester United fans now towards the title race that they've no involvement in? They're looking at Liverpool ghosting into a 12-point lead, City 13 points behind. Have they come to this acceptance that Liverpool are just a phenomenally good side and they are going to win the league and we're miles off it?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for everyone. I can only speak for myself. That for me, like, I was kind of torn this season anyway. At the beginning of the season, obviously, you think, well, one Liverpool City is going to win the league. This is, yeah, and it would be nice when each season as a United supporter doesn't start with damage imitation and making these ludicrous deals with yourself about the different kinds of awful that you're prepared to accept. For me, at the beginning of the season, I probably would have preferred Liverpool to win the league than City on the basis that I grew up with Liverpool winning the league. I know what Liverpool winning the league is. And they've gone well beyond United's 26 years without a league title. And it's going to happen at some point. So if Liverpool win the league this season and City don't win the European Cup, then it sort of closes, in my mind anyway, it sort of closes the debate about who the best team is of the Premier League era. And it isn't going to be City. Because if they only end up with, this team wins two league titles and no European Cups, then to me that compares unfavourably with two of Fergie's teams that have won three league titles in a row and a European Cup to go with it. So I guess the pact that I had made was that actually I would prefer United maintaining that status and Liverpool winning the league than City winning the league. But I mean, ultimately, I think you probably, it would be nicer if it was perhaps a bit closer so that one of them suffered heartbreak at the end. But then I guess one of them suffers that kind of elation at the end as well. So, I mean, we're not talking about anything good here.
It's like the death penalty or a life sentence. Yeah.
These are the ludicrous deals we have to make with
ourselves. I mean, we got a guy on, a purported football expert this morning, in Daniel Harris, who admitted to making a deal with himself before the start of the season. We get it all here in OTBAM. Final question for you, Daniel. You would have been familiar very much with the Moyes reign, which was the first, I suppose, post Fergie management of many that would be deemed failure since Fergie left. But there's obviously talk from going back to Everton. What are your thoughts?
That would make me laugh, I suppose. Because the last game of, definitely make me laugh. The last game of Moyes' manager at United was at Everton. And the Everton fans were singing, stuck with Moyes, Man United, which was funny. I mean, I appreciate, because it was that, when you know that a manager is gone and you want the manager to be gone, there's an element of inner peace at how bad the team are. So when United went to Everton that day, and basically, poor little Juan Mata tried quite hard, and the rest of them barely moved. And we were kind of standing there thinking, this is absolutely horrendous. But because it's so horrendous, this has got to be it. Like, we're all pretty sure that that was it. And there was something quite relaxing about that, because the period of Moyes getting appointed as manager, thinking this is an absolutely ludicrous appointment, what on earth are they playing at? Through all the, like, a smashing from Liverpool, a slapping from City, and losing at home to Fulham, and all the nonsense that happened under Moyes, when that came to an end, that was actually quite a good day, which meant that Everton fans singing, stuck with Moyes, Man United, was kind of funny, because you go to the game, you appreciate that other fans taking the piss out of you, you think, yeah, that's actually a good song. I do appreciate that. But the opportunity to laugh about it all these years later, how many years later are we, 5 years later, would be enjoyable. So I would be pleased for that to happen. I think Everton would be absolutely off the wall to do it, which is one of the reasons I would be extremely unsurprised if it happened, because that's the kind of thing that Everton do. So, yeah, I hope that happens. But if I was an Everton fan, I would be fervently hoping that doesn't happen.
What's your prediction for the City United game?
Oh, gosh, don't do that to me. You're trying to make me ruin my day here. If I was being honest, I would probably take City maybe 3-2 or something.
Good game.
But But yeah, what will actually happen is United will win 17-0.
Well, that's just beautiful, Daniel. Have a lovely weekend.
You too. Shabbat shalom. See you in a bit.
Yeah, we've spoken about inner peace, making a deal with yourself, pining over your ex. It's only 8:30.
Yeah, this has been an emotional morning.
I do like the boy Harris.
It's about to get more emotional as well because we're going to get into the proper debate.
Yeah, we're moving on to our sporting moment of the decade. An intriguing tie. We have Brady's feel-good header against Michael Conlon, calling out corruption at the core of Olympic boxing. Who could forget? But here is a reminder of what it sounded like when Brady stuck the ball in the Italian net.
Well, is that it? Have we seen the moment pass? Well, it might have happened. Let's hope not. Houlihan.
Oh, Robbie Brady, you hero. We thought we'd missed our chance. We're heading to the last 16. France, bring it on Sunday. What a cross from the right-hand side. And Robbie Brady gets between the defence and heads it past Sirigu. What a moment. What a goal. We're heading to the knockout stages. And don't Ireland deserve it? They've been brilliant tonight. They have killed this really poor Italian side. They've been all over them. We thought our chance was gone. Wes Hoolan, he didn't deserve to be the villain of this tournament. And Robbie Brady has got Wes. He's got Ireland. He's got all of us out of jail. We are surely going through to the last 16.
Yeah, I'm really annoyed with myself because I made a point of looking up something here. When I was going to bed last night, I was like, right, because I had I've quite a
shock. No, we're on air right now, Johnny. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so this is fine. Discuss for a start.
That goal? That moment?
Okay, discuss, because I'll make it very, very... This is going to work out perfect. It's a little bit of a last-minute.com job. It's going to work out absolutely perfect. Will I just go with it? Okay. This week was Paul McGrath's 60th birthday. My father rang me. He said, do you know whose 60th birthday is today? Paul McGrath was an absolute legend in our family. And that of Manny, growing up in Ireland, rural Ireland, be it, wherever you were. And Paul McGrath's performance in 1994... against that Italian side, Ray Houghton put the ball in the Italian net and all that, was one of my abiding sporting memories. I can not remember much about Robbie Brady's that particular win. And the reason I think, and the anniversary of this came up, I remember during the year, and I was like, the fact that we're still talking about this game shows how bankrupt in terms of ambition we are as a football nation, because this was the equivalent of beating a horse who didn't want to win, essentially. And I put it to you, this is the Italian team in 1994. Pagliuca, Costacorta, Maldini, Baresi, Tassotti, Albertini, Baggio, Donadoni, Evani, Baggio, Giuseppe Signori. This was the Italian team that played Ireland that night in the Robbie Brady goal. Sirigu. Schilio. Ogbonna, Zaza, Fiorenzi, Motta, Thiago Motta, Immobile, Sturaro, Barzagli, Bonucci, and Bernadeschi.
They didn't exactly roll off the tongue.
Like, I should know more about this. The bench was Buffon, De Rossi, Cellini, and so forth.
I get what you're saying. I do get what you're saying, but like, we're not the Robbie Brady goal, we're not comparing that to Ray Houghton against Italy in 94. I don't think many people are.
We were in the first expanded Euros?
Yeah, yes.
So obviously, like, they give you every chance to progress. And even though we finished third in the group now, we've gotten the potential of the playoffs and so forth. We might well progress to play in Dublin next year. My problem was, I don't remember that much about the game, apart from the fact that Wezzo had to kind of make up for his miss by putting in that outrageously good ball for Robbie Brady. But like, the Italians that night, like the team they had out and their attitude in the game, it was a typical Italian. They just didn't really care. They didn't really care. So we kind of had a free shot at a team that was already qualified and ultimately didn't care. And as much as the Martin O'Neill era became horrible to watch, and some of our football in that tournament against Sweden and Italy wasn't bad, we went out in reasonably honourable terms or whatever. It just shows that we celebrated that so much.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's the specific elements of that moment.
This was amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
With his family.
I think if Robbie Brady had scored 15 minutes into the game and Ireland went through the motions and held on and got the win that they needed to go through, we would have been saying, God, that was a great night. But I don't think it's something we would have been talking about as one of the absolute great moments of the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But I think the fact that it was, from speaking to people who were there, the atmosphere in Lille,
the emotion.
Closed-roof stadium, an arena stadium, Ireland having absolutely battered Italy from start to finish and just couldn't get the breakthrough. Wes had the chance. It was an absolute sitter. And you were thinking, that was the chance.
Chance is gone.
That's it. That's gone. And I missed Robbie Brady's goal because I was looking over at my dad. It was myself and my dad watching in the living room. I remember it well. And I was looking over at him, just still talking about, that was the chance. That was the moment. TV is over here.
This attack took place over several seconds, and you were just looking at your dad in the dying moments of European group stages.
And it was still 5 minutes to go.
I was
talking to
you. You missed the bloody goal. You missed it. We don't have the goal. You missed the goal.
I caught the ball like just going into the net because as I was talking,
I can tell you it was a great cross.
He's sitting there, kind of half listening to me, watching the TV, and I just see a kind of a the eyes kind of bolt up. So I look back across, and I just see the ball going in.
I don't know. I mean,
I think it was the whole moment, and we saw the picture there of him, like, you know, finding his brother and his partner in the crowd.
That was lovely.
And like, that is
his brother who looks so like him.
Like that's probably I'd say up there with the best Irish sports photos of the last 10 years.
It was, I think, the photo and the emotion of Robbie Brady's goal and just the frustration of the game at that point. And it was like we're out of the group or whatever, into the last, what's that?
16.
Last 16 from 20. From 24.
Well, yeah, no, my point, I don't know, I don't think it's the best moment of the last 10 years, but I think it is a great one for the specific little things that kind of added to it.
Yeah, and also the fact that...
I was saying if it had happened at a different stage of the game or something like that. Or
we've been shite for the last 10 years, effectively, in football, and we've been crap for a while now, and I'm kind of just fed up with watching Irish teams that you don't really want to watch anymore. That Irish team wasn't bad. It'd be lovely to see Robbie Brady and back among the goals. It'd be lovely to see him rediscover his form as well. Michael Conlon was the other half of that debate, and we have a clip of him telling us exactly what he thought in Rio, and this is one that I think we all remember.
Michael, you've a lot to get off your chest after that.
Yeah, you burst teeth. They're fucking teeth. Someone's that, that's me. I never boxed for Aba again. They're cheating bastards, they're paying everybody. And no, I don't give a fuck, I'm cursing on TV. And retaining this here. That's here to Olympic gold. My dream's been shattered now. But you know what? I have a big career ahead of me. And these ones, they're known for being cheats. And they'll always be cheats. Amateur boxing stinks. From the core right to the top.
And emotional Michael Conlon says he's finished with amateur boxing after being knocked out of the Rio Olympics. The 24-year-old has suffered a controversial and shocked loss in today's bantamweight quarterfinal. Despite appearing to dominate the fight, the judges ruled that his opponent, Vladimir Nikitin of Russia, was the winner by unanimous decision.
I won the first round. I knew I had an engine to go and keep him going back. I was hurting him. I hit him a shot and he yelped in the ring and put it on a bit more and more. Thought I nailed it in the second round. Third round was a bit closer, I'll give it that. But even at that, I thought I still done enough to win. It is what it is. I've lost. My Olympic dream's been ruined.
I did 4 years in journalism at DCU, and I don't really remember any of it, but I was like, what? Can I say shite this morning? And I was a little bit wary of it, and then they played that Michael Conlon clip. Lads, it's like, it's 9:25 in the morning. That's a lot of expletives. He wasn't happy.
It's I'm kind of unsure how to place this one.
It was a very memorable moment.
Yeah, because like
even for those that don't really,
it was a fairly devastating moment for Irish boxing fans and stuff. But when you actually look at what that led to, and that fight was probably the straw that broke the camel's back.
in terms of how bent
in terms
the whole thing
of
was.
Yeah, in terms of how corrupt the sport was.
We've
how much things had to change that might just about give it the nudge over Robbie Brady. Obviously, the Robbie Brady one filled you with more euphoria and stuff, but looking back, that was probably, it was such a significant moment, not just for Irish sport, but for the entire sport of boxing.
I don't care as well if that were from any place other than a Belfast accent. The Belfast accent just makes that
just
so much, like, so much weight. Yeah.
And I remember watching the interview afterwards, watching at home, and you're just like,
wow.
Yeah, this is like, oh my. Within
look
a few
the
minutes,
the, look at the anger. Yeah, like
at first, you were really disappointed for him, and then you were like, this is gripping. Like,
Rio 2016 was memorable for a lot of things that didn't actually
involve sport.
Izzel Cody, who's a regular listener to the show, some of us watched it. That's in relation to the Jason Quigley fight, and are going into work with blacker eyes than either fighter today as a result. Delighted for Jason Quigley, and she obviously hashed. I should have listened to Jason Quigley. He just said Paddy fighting on the 20th of December. Wow. If I'd seen that, I wouldn't have actually praised her tweet in the first place. Yeah, it's hard to keep tabs with everything that's going on in the boxing world. But we have a Vox Pop here. Love an old Vox Pop, Neil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you going to do the Owen Sheehan or the Colin Boohegan take to the streets now? Would it be up your alley?
I don't think Owen's way about the people.
He really has. He's nailed
it's,
the
it's
niche.
It's his turf. His turf. No, I mean, Colin Boog is he's doing his best.
Colin's a good lad. We took to the streets to ask the public, and of course, the public is invariably wrong, but this is what the public thought of that clash.
Which was better, Robbie Brady's dramatic last minute winner against Italy at Euro 2016, or Michael Conlon's now infamous rant at the Olympics in the same year? We asked the good people of Dublin to tell us.
Oh, it's got
to
be Michael Conlon, of course.
Give me a reason why. We know what it is, but give me a reason why.
He's outspoken about corruption in this country, which is rampant, by the way.
Brady. It's to be Conlon, man. Put it all on the line, instead of how it was.
100% Robbie Brady against Italy, yeah.
Be Robbie Brady's goal against Italy.
Brady's. Say be Robbie Brady.
Robbie Brady.
Not to.
Robbie Brady.
Yeah,
not to.
It has to be Robbie Brady.
Robbie Brady.
Why?
Just the emotion I went into it, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Robbie Brady.
I think so. Yeah.
Conlon, I'd say. Yeah, just a probably more seismic moment. Because everything's come out after it, I suppose, it's probably much clearer. It's a more important event in the grand scheme of things than Brady's goal.
Instantly more memorable.
Yeah.
Where were you for that?
America, New York, Bethpage Black Golf Course.
That is a ridiculously specific answer. Thank you very much.
Goal, I'd say.
Robbie Brady, probably positivity of it.
I like Michael Conlon, so that was a good one.
You liked what he said?
Yeah, totally true. Yeah.
Okay.
Needed Brady to score that goal.
Conlon for me.
Conlon. Yeah. You remember Conlon?
Yeah.
And you?
I remember both, but probably Robbie Brady's goal a bit more memorable.
No surprise at all, Robbie Brady's fantastic last minute winner against Italy at Euro 2016 defeats Michael Conlon's controversial interview. There you have it.
Tell you,
that's as bad a decision as yeah. Nikitin got against Michael Conlon.
Yeah, the boy Cullum, he's a face for the TV there. He looks fresh, but I couldn't help but notice an awful lot of people are actually walking away from him.
Yeah,
please leave me alone. I have to go back to work here. Who are you?
No. It's just Robbie Brady. Yeah.
Can I just go now? You know. But nice work from Cullum. Could have a niche there himself. What do you reckon? Tom Bugsy Malone is in the house.
Yeah. How are we? Yeah. I love Colin. Colin has proper dedication. He doesn't let the people escape.
No.
He wants to get his... He's no. getting your opinion.
And look, I mean, Owen has the luxury that the people he's generally speaking
come to him.
Are coming to him.
And have had lots of drink.
Yeah. They've had a few.
Yeah, unless it's a Mayo County Board gathering. Different kettle of fish. Bugsy, what's going on? We were talking racing before the show.
Yeah, we'll carry that at the end.
Vanessa May.
Vanessa May,
she's making,
yeah.
She's making...
Vanessa May
is making hay, and Holly Doyle, obviously, great work for her, became the winning most female jockey in a calendar year with 107 winners at Southall yesterday.
Yeah, that was actually, yeah, I was sorry about that. She made history yesterday, she broke that record. I mean, it's just such a brilliant moment. It just goes to show people like, you know, Hayley Turner and that, like they've broken glass ceilings or whatever. Like Hayley Turner, it was 11 years ago when she became the first female to ride 100 winners in a season, and now here you are. You know, just what, 9 years down the line.
Name her Group 1 winner.
Dream Ahead.
think she had two Group 1 winners.
Her first one, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Dream Ahead, yeah. But she, like, she just shattered glass ceilings, and then good to see her back this year having a Royal Ascot winner as well, with the likes of, you know, Cathy Gannon, Josie Gordon, absolutely class, and then you see this 107 winners. But what it also puts into context is the achievements of Rachel Blackmore.
Yes.
Like, you consider UK flat racing that runs 12 months of the year, 7 days a week, pretty much, and she's got 107 winners. Then you think of Irish Jumps Racing, which runs effectively 3 days a week for 7 or 8 months, effectively. And for Rachel Blackmore to have 90 winners last year, 90 plus winners last year, just
amazing.
Phenomenal.
Neil, Vanessa May, her achievements are all the greater because some of the horses, in fact, a lot of the horses she's riding, only were ridden by Tom Malone in work this year.
Yeah,
Damien English's yard, yeah.
Damien English's yard, yeah. She works
no worse for it, it would seem, or that they're very well handicapped.
Yeah, they're very well handicapped. Yeah. It's taken them a while, in fairness.
Several months.
To get over
Vanessa's it. Vanessa's just gotten on the horses. They're winning Tom Malone, you know, of charity race fame and all that.
Well, I mean, I do weigh a good 4.5 stone more than her as well, which is positive
and
significant.
Rising.
Yeah, it is most definitely.
What
rising.
Is the news?
The news, well, we'll start with football, and the booze rang out around the Emirates Stadium again last night as Arsenal fell to another Premier League defeat. The 2-1 loss at home to Brighton means the Gunners have now failed to win any of the last 9 games in all competition. The North Londoners now 10th in the Premier League table, 10 points off the Champions League spot, and interim boss Freddie Ljungberg cuts a pretty frustrated figure.
I think everybody wants to win. I think the players all want to do it, but it's... not so easy sometimes for them. They've been not winning for a long time and are not used to it, and that's something we as a group have to work on.
Just on that, Neil, what's the point of Freddie Ljungberg going in there? He's virtually no managerial experience. He's obviously done a bit of work underage at Arsenal, but this relationship with the club having played there, to me, is just, I don't get it.
Yeah, well, I suppose they just need a nice watchman, don't they?
Yeah.
Someone while they actually figure out what the next move is.
It is notable that a night watchman is usually a bowler and not a batsman, I suppose. It's probably the most fitting.
Lovely little analogy there. Night watchman or a nocturnal security officer when Dell is giving Rodney a job in NSO.
With absolutely zero experience. Zero suitability.
Bit like us three this morning, really.
Yeah. But there's no one jumping out and going, just handing someone a 4-year deal.
That's fair enough.
You know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Why isn't Eddie Howe mentioned in the running for this job? Like, he's vaguely mentioned. Like, I think there are an awful lot of stupid people at football clubs. Genuinely. Like, they just...
Most people would agree with that.
Well, yeah. I mean, who's next in at Everton? And you're like...
Nice little segue there, Bugsy.
But before we go to that...
tell us.
Yeah, well, they'll have Duncan Ferguson in charge.
He's Big Dunk.
Yeah, well, they've had two... I wonder what's happened to David Unsworth. Why didn't he get the caretaker job this time around? Anyway, or the night watchman job, as it would be. But Duncan Ferguson, he's been in the coach's office since 2014. He'll be in temporary charge for tomorrow's Premier League game against Chelsea at Goodison Park. Toffees in the relegation zone on the back of that loss to Liverpool. They sacked their manager, Marco Silva, yesterday. It is reported the Portuguese Vitor Pereira is in contention to take over on Merseyside. Everton is searching for their fourth permanent manager since Roberto Martinez was sacked in 2016.
Which is pretty mad.
Yeah. And Duncan Ferguson's alongside all those four managers as well. So another one of the night watchmen again. Like I said, it was David Unsworth who got the sort of caretaker jobs in the interim. So not sure what's happened to him. But
David Unsworth and Big Dunk would have played together in those days.
Heyday.
I'm thinking of the coach at that time would have been... Yeah, they had a manager
Joe
for...
Royal for
Joe
a
Royal. Royal. Yeah.
There was a. I remember it was a good old.
I nearly said Jim Roy.
Jim Roy.
I think Joe did a better job than Jim. It was one of those good like pub questions at the time, which obviously I was too young to be in the pub, but I do remember it was like, name the only Premier League manager who's a member of the royal family. Like, don't know. Jim Royal.
Newcastle United, meanwhile, they sprung a 2-0 surprise at Sheffield United in the other game last night to move up to 11th. However, Chris Wilder criticised the officials last night for not sticking to their own advice. Another VAR controversy here. His players appeared to stop for offside when the flag went up before Newcastle's John Joe Shelby scored in Newcastle's second for that 2-0 win last night. VAR reviewed the play and decided the goal should stand as the midfielder was onside. And Wilder says the technology is killing the game.
The linesman sticks his flag up today. We were told at the start of the season that the linesman would keep his flag down. Yeah, I can criticise my players by not playing to the whistle, but when everybody in the ground, everybody, even John Joe, he didn't give me the impression that he was in and he was one versus one with Dean.
I'm pretty sure if you did a vox pop, Colin did a vox pop of football fans, VAR yes or no, just get rid of everything, or as we are now, 75-80% be like, get rid of it. It's really wrecking my head watching games and everything it's doing about enjoying a goal that may or may not be, and it's taken the love out of celebrating goals, I think.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
I don't think it's worth the hassle anymore.
No, if Dele Alli's goal had been disallowed the other night, it could have been the seismic moment where it's like, oh no, this is gone.
We're done.
If it had just, you know, glanced off his... and it nearly did. It was a beautiful piece of skill. If VAR had disallowed that, I think it would be game over. Genuinely, it would have been that bad and so much uproar.
In our daily FAI update, the FAI will publish their accounts for 2017 and 2018 today. A number that seems to be going up by the hour, but it's expected the association will reveal debts of approximately €55 million. And while there is one game in the Championship later this evening as Millwall play Nottingham Forest at the New Den, that kicks off at 7:45. In boxing, Jason Quigley stopped Mexican Abraham Cordero in three rounds in California overnight to win his super middleweight bout. The Donegal fighter was on his first outing under new trainer Andy Lee. While in swimming today, Sligo teenager Mona McSharry's in action in the European Short Course Championships in Glasgow today. The 19-year-old is looking to add to her medal haul, having taken a bronze earlier in the week. She'll be in the pool for the women's 100 metres breaststroke event. She, of course, took that bronze in the 50-metre breaststroke. Shane Ryan also in action later today. And in snooker, Belfast Q's Mark Allen's in quarterfinal action later at the UK Championships in York. A two-time finalist himself in one of the Triple Crown events at the Barbican later. He takes on Nigel Bond, 54-year-old Nigel Bond, who's already knocked out Judd Trump and Gary Wilson on his way to the last eight. And we mentioned Holly Doyle and her record earlier, but there is racing later as well from Dundalk.
Yeah, Owen Couser had a good tweet during the week. He's like, I've no idea how many second halves of games on TV I've missed this season because of FAI stories.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I can relate to Daniel McDonald putting a load of stories in the page one of the paper, page seven of the paper. It's just like, I don't envy them. This wasn't what I... Anyway, thanks for coming in.
Cheers.
Speaking at the Signify Sports Manager of the Year Awards, Jim Gavin, who obviously took home the main award, spoke about his decision to call it a day.
Jim, have you spoken to the players, you know, about this decision, and what did you say to them?
It's pretty straightforward. You know, I met with the players and gave them the news. I reflected on the space that I was given, and I did what was best for my family, my work, and indeed Dublin GAA. And that conclusion I came to was to hand over the reins to a new manager in 2020, and you know, I'm excited to see the team grow again and what the performance that they will no doubt bring in 2020.
Was that team meeting hard, emotional? How would you describe how you felt when you were speaking to the players to tell them that you wouldn't be their manager anymore?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to say goodbye after 12 years, but it has to be done, and it's done.
And I'm sure as well they're all looking forward to what's going to happen in the future. For you, what words would you use to describe what you've done for Dublin in the last 6-7 years?
I've just had a great journey. I've been very fortunate enough to be surrounded by a fantastic management team over many different campaigns. I've had a phenomenal backroom team supporting me, but above all, facilitating the players to be their best. And lastly, the guys that I've worked with, the players, have been just a unique group of men. Their sacrifice, dedication, commitment, honesty, and humility have made me very proud of them, and I look forward to seeing them play in the Dublin jersey in 2020.
And just lastly, I'm sure you know things now are still quite raw, but when you reflect, maybe a couple of weeks, a couple of months, will you miss it?
After 12 years, absolutely. But you know, my focus now is on the local GA club, the under 11 team, and looking forward to that.
Thanks, Jim. Well done.
Fáilte romhaibh.
Cheers. Thank you.
Top Fáilte romhaibh. Alan Quinlan's in the house. Just
morning,
like that.
Lads, how are you?
How are you?
Very good.
Looking forward to the weekend. Big stuff coming up.
Yeah, it is, because it's they're back-to-back games, Johnny, and there's always an intrigue with the back-to-back games. The psychology of, you know, playing the same team twice in a row in a cup-style scenario where
my favorite part of I think the entire club season.
Yeah, it is.
Couple of weeks, because there's just so many little subplots that one game leads into the other.
There is, and I played in so many of them, obviously, over the years, and you beat a team one week and you think you win convincingly against a French team in Thomond Park, and you go the following week and they kick the crap out of you and they beat you, or it's so much more difficult. And, you know, so it's really, the results can changed so much, you know, dramatically. Leinster went in 2013 to Northampton. Obviously, that's the first game, and they beat Northampton 40-7.
Yeah.
Which suggests then that they're going to win at home convincingly the next week. Northampton beat them 18-9. Mm. So sometimes the results, the form, it's kind of like the FA Cup. It just goes out the window sometimes. And now that happened in 2016 again. They won 37-10 in the first game. Really convincing again. They backed it up the week after and won 60-13. But as I said, it's a defining couple of weeks really for teams. Our kind of motto and mentality, and it hasn't changed, is if you've a really tough game away from home, a losing bonus point is not a bad result. And then you win with a bonus point, or you get 5 to 6 points in two games.
Mike McCarthy is on co-coms with Neil tomorrow in Northampton. How are you getting on, Mike?
Hi, lads. Morning. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. This is an intriguing game, as Quinny says. They're back-to-back. They're in the Aviva Stadium early next Saturday, I think. Next Saturday week?
Northampton yes. Tomorrow and then the Aviva.
Saturday week. Intriguing couple of back-to-back games here for Leinster.
Yeah, big time. As Quinny was saying, I actually played in the 2013 one where we hammered them at Franklin's Gardens. And then, you know, if you're just slightly a few percent off mentally going into the next game, you can get turned over as we were. And we were probably just a bit complacent in the week during training, thinking we're probably a bit better than we actually were. And we got overturned full house at the Aviva. So, Jamie Heaslip, dropped the ball, unfortunately, just to win the game at the end. But we're way off the performance we had the week before. And, you know, that's a thing mentally. If you're just a few percent off, as we know, you can 1 week's a long time in a rugby game.
How are you, Mike? Tomorrow's game, it's actually set up perfectly as well, just the sheer fact that how it's fallen. Leinster and Northampton, 9 points each, top of the pool, both have one bonus point win and one regular win. Like, it's looking like a straight shootout between the two of them for first place in the pool, and whoever comes through tomorrow, you'd have to think, has a really good chance of, you know, pushing on and actually getting through to a home quarter final as well. Northampton, from what we've seen so far, they've kind of flattered to deceive over a few years, and I've kind of disappointed at times as well in the last few years. But based on the Premiership and what we've seen in the Champions Cup so far, they look like they're slowly becoming the real deal again.
Yeah, it's hugely exciting. I mean, two teams in incredible form. Obviously, Leinster have won 7 from 7 in the league, 2 from 2 in the Champions Cup, and Saints have won 4 from 5 in the league. And Chris Boyd's really starting to show his class from being there for a while now. And they've got a great forwards coach in Phil Dowson, who worked with Stuart Lancaster, captain with England, and he's a great leader, and you know their forward pack's playing incredibly well, and exciting for Northampton. Last week they had Matt Proctor, capped once by the All Blacks. He played his first Premiership game against Leicester last week and made 140 metres ball in hand, so he's really exciting. That centre partnership with him and Rory Hutchinson looks really exciting. Dan Bigger pulled out before the game against Leicester last week, and a guy, James Grayson, who was actually doing a pre-game fitness test, got called in late and completely ran the show. But so interesting to see whether Bigger starts or James Grayson. And the same, Courtney Laws also pulled out before the game. So, two teams in great form, and we saw what Leinster did last week with their second team. Against Leon Leinster, the back row, Reese Ruddock, Max Deegan, Josh van der Fleer were incredible, and then amazing to see against Glasgow and winning in Scotstoun for the first time in 7 years. The back row there, Caelan Dorris, Josh Murphy and Will Connors, 48 tackles, none missed. So the strength and depth Leinster have got, we all know about. They used 57 players in the league last season, so it's a really exciting matchup. And Northampton may be a little bit lucky to be 2 from 2 because they nearly lost that game against Treviso, but for a little bit of Dan Bigger magic at the end to get them over the line to win the game.
That is the mad thing as well, Quinny, about Leinster. Just the strength and depth is off the charts this season. The amount of players they've been able to use and comfortably use in both competitions, bringing in third or fourth choice players at times and looking not that much worse for it.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a Premiership side that's... they don't go out and sign any players. Leinster don't sign
just
players because they don't need to sign players. Mike mentioned there Will Connors, 48 tackles in 2 games, none missed. He's another kind of superstar on the scene. And
And there's a fair chance we won't even see him over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, because Van der Fleer and Max Deegan and probably Ruddock will be the captain. I think they haven't had to overextend themselves. I think we're talking about really good form here, but Leinster have just managed. But their depth has really been the key for them in the Pro 14, and integrating back in the internationals has worked pretty seamlessly for them, and the results have been positive. They've, you know, the win against Benetton in the RDS, you know, wasn't, they were tested a few times. They didn't play probably their best game. They looked a little bit rusty, which is understandable. The win in Lyon, it was a very, very it's what you expect from Leinster now, is to go to France and win. So there was a time where any sort of a win in France was a magnificent result. Now it's routine. We're critiquing the performance, you know. So it's hard to know. This is a real test for, because Northampton will fancy this one. They've had a bit of consistency in selection because they didn't have that many guys away at the World Cup. So that does build a bit of momentum, and they're top of the Premiership. They've lost one game. That was away to Bath, but they've been pretty impressive. So they've built a little bit of momentum up. They're missing Courtney Laws and Owen Franks, which are two kind of big players for them. But Bigger is going to be back this week, and that'll be an interesting battle between him and Sexton.
Just bring Mike in on that. What are the interesting matchups? Obviously, Sexton, Bigger. Where is this game going to be won and lost, Mike?
Yeah, well, they always say it's won and lost up front, but you know, you look at the back rows. They've got an incredible back row. Tom Wood with that experience, and then Tamana Harrison and Lewis Ludlam. You know, younger guys who've been playing incredibly well, and that's an exciting matchup against Josh Van der Fleer, Reese Ruddock and Max Deegan. So yeah, that's really exciting. You know, obviously Dev Toner running the line out. He's very difficult to, from a Northampton point of view, he's going to be really important in terms of winning set piece. You know, and I think it comes down to who's on top in the, you know, laying the foundations in the scrum, the maul early on. And, you know, when you go away from home, obviously discipline's hugely important. If your discipline's poor, as Leon saw against Northampton a few weeks ago, where they gave, I think it was 20-plus penalties away, you just don't give yourself a chance to win the game. So, you know, they've got to bring a real physical edge going away to Franklin's Gardens, playing against Saints, who are in great form, but they've also got to be very well disciplined as well.
Mike, before we leave you go as well, just there's a lot of people saying this morning Jameson Gibson-Park likely to get the nod at scrum half ahead of Luke McGrath. Do you think maybe that is something to do with like the threat that Cobus Reinach has at scrum half for Northampton, and how quick he is, to have someone maybe with the pace of Jameson Gibson-Park in there to kind of deal with him a little bit more?
I mean, it's a tough one for a front five forward, to be honest, but Quinny might have a better answer than me, but Luke McGrath's no slouch, to be honest. So you know, they're both very quick, so I can't see that would be the reason against obviously Reinach, a World Cup winner, incredible player. But I think it just sums up the depth in Leinster. You know, you've got Luke McGrath, Jameson Gibson-Park, who's now obviously Irish qualified as well, which is pretty exciting to see whether he'll be involved in February. But you know, with the form Cooney's showing as well. Exciting from an Irish perspective as well, the amount of quality scrum halves there are. But yeah, I'm not sure the ins and outs of why, you know, who's ahead of who, but you know, the two quality scrum halves, and whoever they pick is likely to do an incredible job against Reinach.
Who wins, Mike?
Sorry?
Who wins?
I think Leinster are going to win. I think they will. Just, I mean, the form they've shown is incredible. They've had a chance to rest their frontline players last week, putting their second team out against Glasgow. Sometimes that goes against you, but you know, I think Leinster are just going to have a little bit too much for Northampton.
Thanks for your time.
Cheers, guys. Thanks very much.
Just cheers, Mike.
A reminder that Mike is on duty tomorrow with Neil. That's going to be an absolute cracker, Northampton versus Leinster. Quinny, what do you make of it?
Yeah, no, I think he's right about, I think Leinster, like I said, Northampton, it's kind of, you're not really sure all a couple of these Premiership games are on while all the players are away. They have been impressive and they have built a bit of momentum. So it is going to be a tough place to go. They beat a very, very, well, it's hard to know, a very, very good Leicester team on paper last week.
Yeah,
it's Lavanini and
strictly on
Lagi,
paper is the Jones, emphasis there.
Johnny May, all their English internationals back.
Leicester were bad.
Leicester were bad.
But also as well, I would say as well, Northampton, some of the rugby they played in it, like, they saw that Leicester were bad and they absolutely hammered the foot down on the throat.
And they've a lot of good young players who, so look, some of their players are a little unknown, and then some of them we do know of them. There's only five, I think, in the group from 2016. So it's been, Chris Boyd has done a really good job, the New Zealander there. So, but look, I think Leinster have the pedigree and they probably have the mentality and that little bit of resilience to go there and get a result. So I don't see them losing there.
They had a near miss last year, obviously. Are they very much on track for winning the Heineken Cup?
Are they on track? Yeah, of course they are. Mm. Yeah, of course they're going to be very close again. Look, when you get down to the last stage, I think it's sometimes it can be a little bit of tactical stuff. Yeah. And you know, you saw the final with Leinster against Saracens. They were superb, 10 points up in the final. And then just tactically, I think, against a very, very powerful physical side, they probably ran into the strong defensive areas around the side of the ruck, and Saracens kind of smashed them there and out-muscled them a little bit. So they'll learn from that, but they're definitely going to be knocking on the door again. There's no doubt about it.
You mentioned Saracens. They travel to play Munster at 5:30 tomorrow, which is probably maybe a slightly closer game on paper, and a fascinating one to call as well.
Yeah, it's hard to know what, with all the...
Where do we start?
Yeah, where do we start? There's so many stories.
But even like who's gonna be playing for Saracens is the big question.
And I think, for any of the viewers who don't know the story, Saracens were fined $5.5 million and docked 35 points from the Gallagher Premiership a couple of weeks ago for irregularities, or was it proven, or what kind of statements did they come out for breaching the salary cap?
Breaching the salary cap.
But nobody can see.
It's disputed by Saracens that it was deliberately. They've accepted the punishment.
That there were administrative errors, which is strange.
They're saying they acted in good faith.
They didn't appeal it. Look, at the end of the day, there's going to be an asterisk around tagged on to Saracens from now going forward. And it's a shame, really, because we're used to playing teams with massive budgets in France, 25, 30 million. Saracens' budget wouldn't be that much, be a lot less than that. But they obviously have a salary cap in the Premiership in England that you have to adhere to. A number of the English Premiership clubs were breaching it slightly a few years back, and there was always talk, and you'd hear whispers within the game about certain clubs doing certain things and offshore accounts. And Saracens were one that was mentioned to me a few times, and it's obviously that wasn't proven, but from what I hear is everybody got a little rap on the knuckles, and they were all brought in a couple of years ago, and they signed up to an agreement, and this was the case, and any breaches would be dealt with significantly. They got the most severe punishment.
Couldn't have been more severe.
We can't read the. It'd be brilliant to be able to get the document and read it and highlight the print and say, well, this is exactly what they did. It's to do with co-investment for players.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously if market value. Now, what they have done, Saracens, in fairness to them, they produce fantastic young players.
Yeah.
Their academy system is right up there, and they've developed that, and Martin McCall has done a magnificent job.
That's where they've voiced their frustration that they have been put into a situation whereby they are sort of like Leinster, except you're dealing with a salary cap where they are producing so many absolutely outstanding players, and they're almost being punished for it, is their opinion.
And in simple terms, when they become England internationals, which a number of them have
suddenly
done,
they command
and suddenly
enormous
their
wages.
Agent goes in to Saracens and says, well, market value now is 400,000 or 500,000.
Now there 600,000. There are exceptions made in the salary cap. You kind of get allowances, and for marquees, but also there are kind of things in place for that. If you are producing lots of good players yourself, you kind of get credit in the bank. Essentially,
there's a lot of complicated kind of things that can happen in there, but ultimately, if your salary cap, I'm not sure what the number is 7.5 or 8 million or something like that, they're well above that.
Yeah.
Mm. So that, to be fined the amount they have, they must have been well above that. And what they were doing, we hear and we're told, is they were doing co-investments with players. So if Johnny Ward wants 600,000, that is market value, and they can't squeeze that 600,000 into their budget because they can only squeeze 400 in, so they're going to take 200 off you, 200 off you, 200 off you, but they were going to give you an investment, which is your is a value to you.
Right, to, so, to Johnny W Investments Limited.
And you're going to get an investment in property or something like that. So
it's really getting me buzzed up for the FEI accounts later on. But,
you know, in fairness, it'd be a brilliant way to operate if the salary cap wasn't there for them.
Yeah.
Because as a player, I think you'd definitely be keen to say, right, okay, rather than take the salary, give me an investment that hopefully will grow and that... It's kind of bricks and mortar, if you like.
Let's talk about the game, the very dramatic game against Racing showed that Munster's their courage and their heart and all that. A game they probably could easily have won, obviously, in the end.
There's 10 line breaks in that game, and it's something that we're not used to seeing Munster making clean line breaks. I thought their ambition and the way they played, you could see maybe a little bit of a change in the way they're trying to play. The problems and issues they had were they defended poorly and soft at times. Now, Racing came to Thomond Park and it was an absolutely superb performance, and they have the depth in their squad and the power to do that. So it wasn't a game that I went after as I'm going to criticise Munster, because I thought they actually did so many good things. Yeah. But what they didn't do was they didn't actually go play a little bit of smart old school Munster rugby, if you like. The stuff that is just tight, good kicking, hard runners, frustrate the opposition. They actually played the way they played Racing, kind of it allowed them to play a little bit, and they didn't impose a pressure game on their breakdown or their set piece. And so they look back on that with regret, I think, at the end of this competition.
And also Saracens go into the game thinking there are chinks there that they can expose.
Yeah, and we'll, the thing, Johnny, is what team will Saracens pick? Because obviously they can only play their internationals for so many games. Are they going to focus on the Premiership? Will they play their players in Europe? Then they might be able to play them for Premiership games when it counts to try and stay up this year.
For the first couple of games, there's kind of been, it's been a half and half kind of. They have had a few of their kind of marquee England players out there, and they've had a few of the, you know, the less high profile players.
If I was them, I'd
there.
Play the group that played against Ospreys 2 weeks ago, who's still a very, very good side, and they're well capable of beating anyone. Okay, they wouldn't be as strong if the Vunipola brothers are there and Atoja and Farrell and that, but they can afford to win their three home games, and they're going to get a bonus point win in Ospreys anyway. So four wins is going to get them out anyway. So I don't know if they're going to bring the big
are Munster tomorrow. Are Munster already in must-win territory for this game
Absolutely.
Tomorrow?
The place will be rocking
because
tomorrow for this.
Yeah, if they lose tomorrow, that's two home games that would have dropped points in. Realistically, if they were to lose tomorrow, they'll have to go to Allianz Park and to Paris and pick up wins in both of those games.
If because of the draw, they have to get one of these away wins in either Saracens or in Racing. And I think, I have a feeling Saracens will pick all the big guns next week at home, and they're practically...
Even if Saracens were to lose this week, do you still think they'd come all guns blazing next week?
Yes.
Having had two defeats?
In practical terms, Neil, I think if Saracens win their three home games, they've already won the home game against Ospreys, they can win the home game against Munster, the home game against Racing, and they'll win away with a bonus point win in the Ospreys. The way they're at the moment, I mean, that don't mean to be disrespectful to them, but that's where they're at the moment. Four wins will get you very close to getting out of this group. The where Munster are at, they have... you know, they've won one and drawn one, but one of the draws at home, that's the problem, you know. So they have to get something on the road now against Saracens or Racing.
Prediction time?
It's very hard to predict this one, Johnny, because we need to see the teams.
I think it really drives me bloody
demented.
Maybe with the GAA teams out on the Thursday for the pro.
They should be out on the Thursday for a Saturday game, and it's something that Europe should do, the internationals do it, so you can then look...
Well, you're spoofing, because how can I call a game I don't know who they're playing?
Yeah, because if they pick all the big guns, I think Saracens can win in Thomond Park. If they leave them out, they'll still be very dangerous, but I think Munster, out of pure desperation and out of maybe fixing some of the issues they had the last day and maybe executing some of those line breaks, I think they've enough to win the game.
So Connacht go to Gloucester on Sunday, and Ulster face Harlequins tomorrow at 3:15.
Connacht Gloucester as well. You'll hear that on Off the Ball as well.
On Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, myself and John Muldoon.
It's tricky for them. I know we're probably only, we're caught for time here, but I think Connacht, it's been a tough start from the Montpellier game at home. They won it nearly late on, a couple of points. It was a brilliant win. They've had so many injuries in the first couple of rounds away in Toulouse then for that game where they actually played brilliantly with...
Yeah. I think missing out on the losing bonus point and then conceding a bonus point try,
but I think
that's a stinger on them.
Like. Yeah, this is one that... Would you fear going to Gloucester?
I don't think they would.
No, they won't fear there.
But they've plenty of experience playing against them over the last few years as well.
Team selections, who have they back and stuff, but I think it's a really good chance there. And for Ulster... winning away in Bath, they have a little bit of steel and resilience that we haven't seen in recent years, that bit of toughness that you need to dog it out. They showed that in Bath and beating Claremont at home, one of the favourites, along with Leinster and Saracens, was impressive. So I think they can build on that against Quinns tomorrow, get a good result. And again, they'll probably put Quinns out of the competition if they get a good result against them and go there next week. So I think Leinster are the ones who are going to win. Leinster... will win the back-to-back, both of them. I think Ulster...
Confident?
Yeah, they'll win both games this week and next week, and I think Ulster can probably do the same. I think Munster won out of two. And Connacht, yeah, they could... A losing bonus point in Gloucester wouldn't be bad for them, and then beat Gloucester next week. So
I think if Connacht were to go and win this weekend, you'd be very confident
they'd go and do it next week. So it's I think the way they play and the kind of confidence that Andy Friend has instilled in them. But look, ultimately, it depends where Gloucester are at. How much they want it at home, because it's a tough place to go, King's Home.
You're in Thomond Park?
No, I'm in Northampton.
You're in Northampton as well?
Northampton, Leinster. Yeah.
But both you're off to Northampton tomorrow.
Exactly, yeah.
Virgin Media, yeah.
And
he's for News Talk.
Yeah, we specifically off the ball.
Off the ball, thanks for that, Quinny.
With Mike McCarthy and Brendan Macken. Thanks for coming in, Quinny.
Cheers,
and giving a plug to a rival station. After the break, we have a clip from this week's Off the Brawl. It's a former world champion, Paulo Malignaggi. He will be breaking down Andy Ruiz versus Anthony Joshua. OTB
AM. So Joshua, going into that fight, there were rumours, more or less after the fact, that he might have been knocked out in sparring or he had like a panic attack before the fight. But what was clear that he wasn't quite in the right headspace as the fight transpired, or he could never quite get into the fight. How, from your own experience, difficult is it to say if you underestimate opponents to like go up the gears during a fight, or are you kind of stuck in that limbo from the start of the fight?
Yeah, mentally you weren't ready for the fight. It's kind of hard to get your gears going once you're in the fight, you know. You need to be mentally ready with a full tank of gas, mentally and physically, and ready to kind of, you know, burn that gasoline in the fight, you know. And it just, if you don't have that mental capacity going into the fight, you're not going to pick it up on the way into the fight or even once the bell rings, because at that point, the danger is in your face. And mentally, you're not able to, you know, deal with it. And it seemed a little bit like AJ just wasn't able to deal with the kind of fight that Ruiz brought. Maybe he didn't expect it or whatnot. But nonetheless, Ruiz is, like I said, is a quality guy, and AJ should have been more ready.
And did you have any experiences like that in your own career where maybe you got more than you bargained for from an opponent?
Yeah, of course. You know, I had a guy early in my career also who was a Mexican fighter like Ruiz, and he kind of played me the same way. You know, it was very nice at the weigh-in, you know, taking pictures with me and whatnot. And it kind of throws you off, you know, if you haven't experienced that yet, you know. And he was just too nice, and I ended up kind of feeling bad for him. But then come the night of the fight, he got in my face a lot, you know, and it was a fight that I had to work a bit harder than I anticipated to win. You know, luckily he wasn't on my level, so I was able to handle it, but still, it was the kind of fight where, you know, you end up taking some shots you shouldn't have took, you know, and, you know, people criticize a lot when you're a prospect because they want to see perfection, and rightfully so, because you're not fighting opponents that should be testing you a lot, you know, and so, you know, it was definitely my learning experience to say that no matter what a guy's mentality seems like, once the bell rings, you have to assume that they are always ready to come hurt you and come take you out, so you have to have the same mentality, otherwise, you know, you're going to risk being run out of there.
Yeah, and one point on the first fight, Paulie, Rob McCracken came in for a little bit of criticism for his instruction in the corner or maybe the overall game plan. If you were in Joshua's corner for this fight, what kind of instructions would you be giving him as opposed to what he did in the first fight?
You know, everything's hindsight is 2020, so I don't think it's fair to, for everybody to kind of just be criticizing now, because it's easy to look back and say, you know, when you play the Monday morning expert, yeah. You know, it's easy to look back and say, okay, you know, it should have been this way. But in the moment, when the pressure is on, it's a lot different. You know, there's a lot of different feeling, and you have to kind of make certain decisions and you have to say certain things in that moment. You know, so the pressure is obviously on, and it's a lot more difficult to come up with, you know, the right things to say sometimes. But nonetheless, I do think, you know, AJ has to impose himself both from a boxing standpoint and from a physical standpoint. But it's a little bit difficult from that just to say that. Just to say that basic, because Ruiz has a tendency to punch with you, so you need to mix in your tactical with your feints, and so that he's not, so that when he's trying to punch with you, you're throwing it off, you know. Because if you're feinting him out of position, then he's sort of, him trying to punch with you is going to get all thrown off and all discombobulated. And then of course mixing your feints with enough shots that land, because if shots are not landing, your feints are not going to work. Guys aren't going to bite on them because guys are not going to be nervous. So you need to make your jab count, you need to make your feints count, you need to make your shots count. And you have to balance all those things out. And I think if you do that enough, I think you have to actually get the knockout, because Joshua's a very heavy puncher. And, you know, Ruiz is a small guy who obviously is able to be knocked down by Joshua, as we saw early in that fight.
Yeah. And a lot has been said over here about maybe Joshua employing tactics similar to the Joseph Parker fight. Are those fights comparable, Parker and Ruiz's style, or do you think it's just generally more Joshua needs to fight at distance and take a points decision if that's what comes?
I don't know. You know, I did hear Josh was talking to Vladimir Klitschko, so I could see him taking a safe approach to the fight. You know, there's also situations where when Vladimir fought short guys, he'd kind of lay on top of them when they got too close. So that he'd force a break, and then from the break, he wind up forcing the smaller guy to fight on the outside again. When they get too close, he just kind of lean on them all over again, you know? So I could also see this fight becoming such a tactical, almost boring kind of fight, you know, where AJ doesn't allow Ruiz to kind of fight on the inside. He'll kind of just lay on top of him and force a break, and then force Ruiz to fight on the outside. And if Ruiz becomes impatient from the outside, he may run into a big right hand and get knocked out, you know. So I could see from a tactical perspective that too, you know, where you're trying to see what's going to work for you and what's not going to work for you. But you're honestly going to really come to grips with it once the bell rings, and you're going to see for yourself, you know, kind of which of the things you prepared for might work better than others, you know, because you prepare for certain different things, and then some things might catch and some things don't.
Yeah. And one thing Ruiz had on his side, and you've alluded to it already, he had the element of surprise that maybe those in the Joshua camp didn't quite take him seriously. That's gone now. Do you think that affects his mindset or his mental approach much going into this one?
I don't think so, because fighters from Mexico tend to be very prideful in their fighting ability, in fighting for their culture, for their race. So I think that always comes in the ring with you when you're a Mexican fighter. There's that pride, that machismo. So I don't think the element of surprise is something, even though he can't rely on it this time, I think it's always superseded by the pride in your culture. And the pride in your culture comes from all the great fighters that come from that culture in the past. So I think as Mexican fighters, the reason they're always able to charge themselves up is because they can always think of themselves as the next guy in a line of great fighters from that heritage. So he's always got that in his locker. You know, he can always say, you know, I'm a Mexican fighter. Doesn't matter if this guy is great or not, I'm here to fight, you know, and doesn't matter if this guy knows I'm not going to surprise him this time, I'm here to fight. So I expect a motivated Ruiz. Regardless of anything, I don't think him not being able to surprise Joshua is going to affect his mindset.
Yeah, and from a tactical standpoint, like, it's been well covered now that, you know, fast hands from Ruiz are going to give Joshua problems. You know, he's got the short stature as well that Joshua's not quite used to. From a tactical standpoint on Ruiz's side, is it a case of if it's not broke, don't fix it? Or is there anything he could do better or adjust going into this?
Well, I think there's probably more he's going to be able to show if Joshua shows more. You know, he didn't have to really show a lot, because once he hit Joshua, the fight was essentially over, even though it lasted a few more rounds. So I think there's more in what Ruiz can give you and show you. It's just it's got to be brought out of him. And I expect both guys to show more this fight.
And that was an off-the-brawl clip which we had from earlier on. And now we are coming towards the end of the show. We've only around 8 minutes left. But we've obviously had Owen's clip going viral about all the reasons to be cynical. YouTuber bizarrely gets angry at LFC fans for being coy over PL title race. Neil, what do you know about this?
That is Owen Sheehan's, his evil twin. because that guy supposedly writes for On the Ball, or presents for On the Ball. A rival YouTube channel.
We have to describe to the people listening but not watching this photo. It's like a picture tells us. Phil Egan looks...
It's the look he's giving to the camera. It's the perfect screen grab because Phil is looking at him in a, what is this guy on about? And Owen is, having clearly just made the soundest point he's ever going to make, is turned towards the camera, hands up going, you know, I've split the atom here.
Liverpool fans can be a little bit, just a little bit.
Just the tiniest bit.
I put up a tweet during the week giving out about the Van Dijk non-penalty in the Everton game and just got two or three people just saying I was anti-Liverpool. I was like, well, that's absolute nonsense. Dennis Vahey texted in, revisionism, Johnny. No one talks about Norway, Mexico and Holland in 94. Lille was special. A bang average Ireland team played their socks off and still beat an Italian side. Just to clarify, 94 was very, very special. Definitely agree on that. Rossa, Arsenal are a bit like Lens Senior League Saturday side at the moment. Don't know who or what team will turn up each weekend. It's usually pretty crap, to be fair. Reasons to be cheerful. Do you have one reason to be cheerful? I know I'm putting you on the spot here from the year. I have three.
For the coming year. We'll go through your three while I think.
Reasons to be cheerful from... Oh, okay. Go ahead.
For right now.
Yeah. That inspired you from 2019.
I was just about to give...
Actually, let's go for 2020. 2020 vision. What are we to look forward to?
Well, you give us yours while I have a think.
Reasons to be cheerful. I'm going to start with Pat Smullen. And that might sound a little bit wrong. So Pat Smullen is dealing with a horrific condition at the moment. But dealing with pancreatic cancer and battling pancreatic cancer. So... It's been horrific for racing and obviously for the Smullen family, but the way the racing has rallied around that and the money that's been raised for Cancer Trials Ireland has been genuinely astounding. And the day we had the second day of Irish Champions Weekend at the Curra, over 10,000 people there, legends of the sport came out of retirement to ride in a race honouring the cancer trials. There was an atmosphere unlike any I've seen at an Irish race meet, and I thought it was an extraordinary success out of something so harrowing, and it was great, it really was. So that's one reason to be cheerful, just that
that's a good one.
Sport can rally around.
Absolutely.
I suppose when times are hard. The second one I'm going to go for, this is just with the race and hat on with a view to next year, Envoy Allen. He's a reason to be cheerful. He's unbeaten. Cheveley Park's first foray into kind of National Hunt ownership. Extraordinary performance in the Royal Bond at Ferry House last Sunday. He remains unbeaten. I think he's going to be an absolute machine for Davy Russell, who's riding him most of the time. And he is something to get excited about for the long term in terms of racing, and that we still have very good horses in this country. And finally, what's your prediction for my main reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful for 2020. What I'm really just looking forward to is the Irish rugby season next year. Six Nations starts, new head coach, clean slate. Andy Farrell's always been massively popular with all the Irish players. And just to see what he actually does. Who's he picking? Are there any kind of young guys putting their hands up? Guys like maybe Ronan Kelleher at Leinster is one that jumps out straight away. Mike Haley at Munster has had an unbelievable start to the season. Granted, he kind of got in and earned a cap towards the tail end in the World Cup warm-up games. But I'm very much looking forward to just seeing how that plays out. Not really, you know, sticking my hat on, God, there has to be instant results. I think if Ireland were to kind of get maybe 3 wins out of 5 in the Six Nations and kind of go about their business relatively okay, I think that would be a solid enough start for Andy Farrell. But just to see the style of play.
Yeah, that's the thing, because there's no reason to be cheerful from 2019 whatsoever.
And I do think as well that what we see from Andy Farrell will give you quite a solid indication as to maybe how close or far apart himself and Joe Schmidt were during the World Cup.
This is the beauty of Neil, because obviously he was a key part of that team. But if he were taking over a successful Joe Schmidt team...
For example, if he were taken over a year ago after the New Zealand game, he'd be like, there isn't a lot to fix here. But now he's taken over a team where it's like he needs to make changes. He needs to change the philosophy. He has a public that's kind of grown a bit fed up with the sort of the style of the team, I think, to an extent,
yeah,
which clearly has been found out front up against Ireland. We don't have a lot more to offer. And then Ireland are now, whereas they were hot favourites for the Six Nations last year, I think they were odds on. They're now 9-2 behind England. Like, they're not really fancied. So I'm completely with you. I think it'll be fascinating to see what style he imposes on the team. So my final reason to be cheerful is the Irish under-21s.
I knew you were going to throw that in. And why not, in fairness? I mean, they certainly are a reason to make you excited. Stephen Kenny arriving into the senior gig in 2020.
Stephen Kenny...
That's going to make you happy?
Yeah, like, you know, I don't think anyone can say for sure how Stephen Kenny's going to work out. He's a unique individual, and people will still say, how will these Premier League players embrace Stephen Kenny?
It's along the lines of what I was saying about Andy Farrell. You're very much looking forward to seeing, like, is he sticking with the old heads that Mick McCarthy and Martin O'Neill have been playing down the last couple of years?
No.
Or are those under 21 lads that he's been working
with?
How many of those are coming in? How does he marry the two styles together? Yeah.
The 21s are obviously more about the players than Stephen Kenny or his backroom team, Jim Crawford and Keith Andrews. They went to Sweden, were 1-0 down. Sweden were second seeds in the group, hurled at Swedish side, were 1-0 down and absolutely battered them in Sweden and got a 3-1 win. Sweden came to Dublin with a point to prove, were excellent in the first half, 1-0 up at half-time. Ireland battered them in the second half, won 4-1. Played unbelievable football, made changes at half-time. And I think the biggest thing for me was anyone involved in Swedish football who has this notion of what Ireland are that may be more in tune with the way the Danes look at our senior team left Tallaght Stadium that night saying, that's not the Ireland that we would have known and that's a very different Irish team and I hope the future is bright on that score. Is the future bright for Neil Tracy over the weekend, trip to Northampton?
And Gloucester.
Lovely.
Two proper rugby towns.
Yeah.
Franklin's Gardens and Kingsholm, two great rugby grounds.
Your type.
Very much looking forward to that, yeah.
We're going to wrap, but it seems we now have a new section, Neil's 2020 hopes. Neil Tracy's 2020 vision.
2020 vision. Is
I mean, 2020 vision is as bad as the...
Silver bullet.
Silver bullet. That is it, though, for Off The Ball AM for the week, for Friday. Thanks to everyone for coming in and taking our calls on Skype. We're back at 7:30 a.m. on Monday. You can podcast this show. It's fully time-stamped, so it's very easy to find what you want. We're also on YouTube. Subscribe while you're there, and you can Chromecast that or get OTB AM on your smart TV or Apple TV. OTB Sports Radio is live all day, every day on the Go Loud app, and the Go Loud app is to be highly recommended. Off The Ball is live on air and online from 7 p.m. tonight and across the weekend.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.